While the battle to remove President Donald Trump from office following last week's insurrection of the Capitol continues in Washington, D.C., another important political story is playing out in the American South. Last week, after months of fierce campaigning, the Democrats took control of the U.S. Senate, and they did it in Georgia, a state that's been reliably red for almost two decades.
We were told that we couldn't win this election.
Whether you were for me or against me, I'll be for you.
We proved that with hope, hard work, and the people by our side, anything is possible.
It is with humility that I thank the people of Georgia for electing me to serve you in the United States Senate.
That's Raphael Warnock, Georgia's first black senator, and John Ossoff, who also beat the Republican incumbent in the special election. Much of the credit for Ossoff's and Warnock's wins can be attributed to large and sustained grassroots organizing led by Stacey Abrams, the former minority leader of the Georgia House of Representatives. And much of that work was focused on turning out voters of color.
Georgia deserves real leaders, men and women who will stand up for all Georgians and who will do what's right for our people, especially for our military families.
Is the Ossoff-Warnock win a fluke, or does it make Georgia a bellwether for the political future of the rest of the South? That's what we're talking about. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Brandon Miller is a Democratic Party strategist and a partner at Chisholm Strategies, a political consulting firm based in Jackson, Mississippi. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
Anoa Changa is a freelance journalist based in Atlanta and the host of the politics podcast, The Way with Anoa. Anoa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Ested Herndon is a national political reporter at The New York Times. Ested, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with you, Ested. We're talking about the South today, and there's a moment where there was this interesting juxtaposition, I'll call it that, during the Capitol insurrection last week, where there was one of the insurrectionists was walking through the halls of Congress holding the Confederate flag. And yet we have the state of Georgia with two Democrat wins. And this juxtaposition, where does that tell us about where we are today with the South? I mean, it just felt really intense to see that.
Yeah, I think the scenes that we saw last week are kind of an encapsulation of the real split screen we're seeing in American politics right now. You have a real rising multicultural tide, a kind of changing electorate that's particularly been true in Georgia. That's kind of emerged as the state that represents the changing South, the new South, and the kind of coalition that was building there that helped elect these senators. Not only does that include the kind of base of Democrats in the South, which has been Black people and a rise in that vote share, but it also includes kind of new communities coming to the state. You have a rise in Latino voters, AAPI voters, and a break from Republicans among the kind of white suburbs. That coalition together helped elect folks. But at the same time, you have a backlash to that multiracial democracy that has been fueled by President Trump. That is a white grievance-driven mob violence that we have seen across the country, but made its way to Washington last week. Both those tides are very real in this country, and going to forward as a democracy, the kind of open question we wrote last week in the Times was, whose democracy is it? And will the kind of militia, the insurrectionists respect the kind of core tenets that we've come to know about democracy that much of Georgia represented?
Anoa, how much has the Georgia demographics changed? And what I mean by that is, we're talking about grassroots organizers and their role, particularly Stacey Abrams, in securing Democratic wins. And we're thinking Black women, Latinos, a lot of the folks that Stead mentioned, Asian American voters. So how important and how much has the landscape of Georgia changed in the past couple of years?
Mm-hmm. I appreciate the question. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a real increase, not just in raw demographic numerical changes, but in terms of the actual investing in turning out particular voters, and not just showing up like we see in traditional political cycles, you know, a few weeks before an election, but having that deep year-round organizing and engagement by civic engagement, by voting rights orgs, regardless of what type of election cycle it is, or as the case right now, today we start our legislative cycle here in Georgia. We also see, you know, we do see an influx of folks coming into the state who are, you know, more diverse. But we also are seeing, you know, new voters, new Americans in, you know, some areas like Gwinnett County in particular, that are really taking root and taking hold as a part of the democratic process here. And it's also being reflected in terms of the people that are being sent to the Georgia State House in terms of those who have been elected either in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. But to Ested's point earlier about, you know, Black voters and having a larger share, that investment is also not being solely concentrated in the Atlanta metro area. We saw amazing turnout in a runoff in rural areas of Black voters, of other voters of color as well. But when you see someplace like Cuthbert, Georgia, like Randolph County, which made news in 2018 for being targeted for the closure of 7 out of 9 polling locations in a predominantly Black county, to see that resilience now in this election cycle that we just had in terms of that voter turnout is really amazing, on top of the fact that Southwest Georgia in particular has been hard hit by the COVID-19 pandemic and rural hospital closures. So people are tying these issues directly to the political process and seeing that their engagement is also a part of how they can turn some of these situations around.
Brandon, you're the political strategist here, and I'm wondering if you can give us an assessment about how the Democrats, in particular, generally get the state. They've struggled in the South for many, many decades. And, you know, with the occasional election here and there, with the occasional win, largely the South has been considered a Republican stronghold. What did the Democrats do right this time?
First of all, Georgia is a clear case of a state where demographics were, in fact, destiny, right? Democrats have been looking at Georgia for years now. Obama came within about 5 points of winning the state in 2008. Cook and RCP listed their gubernatorial and Senate races in 2014 as toss-ups. And there was some discussion of whether the Clinton campaign should invest there in 16. So, and all that makes sense. Georgia is a state with the second largest African-American population in the country. The Asian and Latino shares of the electorate have tripled since 2008. And then, of course, like Ested was saying, you've got this large urban and suburban white population who are exactly the sort of voters who swung from Romney to Clinton in 2016. So Democrats had all of the ingredients to make win happen in Georgia, but they've not been able to cook one up, so to speak, right? And that's where organizations, most notably Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight, stepped in and were able to register hundreds of thousands of voters and move them to the polls. And so, you know, the dynamic that I think gets talked about less often is actually how close Republicans came to foiling that plan with their own registration and turnout efforts. There were 19 counties in Georgia, mostly in northern Georgia and exurban Atlanta, that had more voters show up to the polls this year than were registered in 2016. And Trump won those counties 71-28. And, you know, overall, Trump increases vote share by about 18%. So in general, both sides have just done a phenomenal job of registering and turning out new voters. And the question in the runoff was, which side's going to do a better job of keeping those voters energized? And Democrats obviously won that contest.
They won that contest, Brandon, but they won it with a very thin margin. And I guess, Ested, I'm wondering if you, based on what Brandon just said, as far as, you know, the Republican turnout, they didn't slouch there either. The margins of the victory here were extraordinarily thin. What does that tell you, Ested, about what this could signal for the future? And I know it's hard to make predictions here, but are we going to see more tight races coming up, do you think?
Well, I think that that's the nature of a purple state, which is now what Georgia clearly is. You know, just because Joe Biden and now the Democratic senators have won there does not mean it has gone from, you know, red to blue. It means, you know, it means that this state is one that's really up for grabs and that can kind of swing with every election, even as the demographic changes and the other changes continue. And I think that that's what we should come to expect. But I think on the Republican side, there's a lot of warning signs. This is certainly a race that they came in to it favored. You had David Perdue not even really campaign in the runoff, not debate his opponent because of that level of confidence. Obviously, he was ahead of Ossoff in the November races. But you just do not have people who, I think the big takeaway from the Republican side is that without Donald Trump on the ballot, you are not seeing those turnout that you need to overcome the losses in urban areas. And so while Donald Trump himself can really increase Republican turnout in some rural areas that can overwhelm the backlash to him in some states. We did not see that in Georgia on the presidential level in November. And then the chaos that was caused in the runoff certainly affected Republicans statewide. And so Georgia remains a state with a lot of Republicans, yes. But I would say that the signs coming out of the runoff are not positive for that state, even though they did have some down ballot success.
I want to talk about that down ballot success. And Noah, like, we're really focused on the big the Ossoff and Warnock wins here. But how have Democratic candidates fared in other down ballot races?
Yeah, I mean, in the runoff, there was so much attention on the two Senate seats that folks often overlook the fact that we had a third race in the runoff, the Public Service Commission, which had a very interesting turnout with the incumbent having actually a high. The Republican incumbent actually had a higher vote share overall than either of the two U.S. Senate candidates, but the Democratic candidate on that ticket did not really meet the same level of threshold and success. And so it raises a couple of different questions and issues when you have this type of strategic, short span of getting people out to vote in terms of making sure folks understand everything that's on the ballot. During the general election, however, we did see some really amazing wins happening in Gwinnett County. You saw elections of, folks to county commission. You saw folks, I think Democrats control the county commission now for the first time in several decades. You saw folks being added to the school board. The sheriff in both Gwinnett County and Cobb County, Democrats took both of those seats. And both were people who pledged to do away with their 287G agreements. And the Gwinnett County Sheriff has already done away with that.
And Noah, what's a 287G agreement, just so our listeners
know? Thank you. 287G, just thinking about it, it's so commonplace to just talk about it in my head. But 287G is an agreement between law enforcement and ICE. And so this was something that organizations like Mahente, like GLAR, Latino-based organizations, BAJI, which is Black Alliance for Justice, for Just Immigration. These are things that organizers have been really advocating for in terms of having, we've had this wave of more progressive minded DAs coming through. Folks have started doing that same shift with sheriffs. And so we saw this coming in, not saying that people are super progressive, but they were willing to at least adopt some policies and agendas that communities have really been pushing under the guise of, we want to keep our community safe, but that means everyone in the community, and having unnecessary interactions with law enforcement could put people in danger of deportation or detention. And so that was really significant. Also, the new DA in Athens County, Deborah Gonzalez, who was the first Latina DA in the state, but also had to sue the government multiple times, the Secretary of State, who everyone has been praising wrongfully, but also the governor in terms of being able to even have her race. So Deborah Gonzalez fought an amazing race to be able to be elected to that position in DA. So we've seen amazing, down ballot wins all up and down the ballot. And that's a testament to the year-round organizing. Yes, the demographics have been trending a certain way, but people have to do that work to educate and inform voters to make sure that they're actually turning out. And that is something that's being done across the South, not just here in Georgia.
Brandon, you are based in Mississippi. We're over here talking about Georgia, but does the win, and you said that Republicans did turn out strongly for Donald Trump. Trump will not be running, at least in the next 2 years, let's say, for the next round of big elections that we're going to see for the midterms. What do you see as far as these wins in Georgia? Are they a bellwether for the broader South politically?
So there's obviously something to learn in the methods that organizers in Georgia use to register and turn out new voters. But in a sort of twisted way, the win in Georgia actually makes things look even bleaker for a state like Mississippi, in the sense that it came without any improvement for Democrats in rural areas. So you have this combined problem for Democrats of population loss in rural Black communities and a shift away from Democrats among rural white voters. So Warnock, for example, got 500,000 more votes in the runoff than Obama got in the 2012 general, and he improved on his net vote share by 8 or 9 points statewide. But 70% of that raw vote increase came from just 6 counties, all in metro Atlanta. And so when you talk about the drop in the rural vote is obviously less important in a state like Georgia, which has one of the largest cities in the country, in Atlanta, but it's critical in other states. So whereas only, a quarter of Georgia's population lived in rural areas as of the 2010 census, half of Mississippi's population was still in rural areas. So if Georgia's win was only possible because of a dynamic, growing, diversifying urban and suburban population, that's something other states just can't recreate. Now, that being said, if I'm the Democratic Party of Texas, which has four of the 11 largest cities in the country, or one of the Carolinas, which are closer to Georgia in terms of the urban-rural divide, I can look at Georgia for clues. But even then, you know, Fair Fight was able to do what it did because it raised about $90 million. That's a lot of money. And so if the lesson here is, you know, hey, other southern states, you too can increase Democratic turnout for the low, low price of $90 million, I think the response would probably be, well, duh. Nationally, Democrats, you know, they need to learn, don't stop investing in places like Georgia, in places like South Carolina, where Democrats were disappointed, right, after losing that Jamie Harrison race. But this isn't the end. 4 or 6 or 8 years from now, South Carolina could be competitive again because it's got those same, you know, demographic changes happening on the ground, the diversifying population, the growing urban population that made Georgia competitive this year.
Instead, I'm curious your thoughts on that analysis, because we mentioned Jamie Harrison, and there was a huge amount of money that, particularly after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that was funneled into a lot of the Democratic senator races, particularly supporting Black candidates. And that had mixed reviews. This $90 million price tag that Brandon is describing for these two races and Stacey Abrams's fight, that looks like it's going to just keep requiring more money to win. Do you see that there are people who are going to stay motivated to continue to donate that type of money to these campaigns going forward? Or was this sort of a one-shot deal because of the president being who he was in office?
I think there's an open question about what level of motivation Democrats will have without kind of the villain of Trump there. Certainly the kind of money we saw this year, not just in the Senate race, but think about in South Carolina with the Jamie Harrison race. Think about the Kentucky race with Amy McGrath and Mitch McConnell, races that were always long shots for Democrats, but were raising historic sums of money. We don't know whether the party's base will continue to be motivated on that front, but we do think that there are some lessons that the National Party has taken from this cycle, like earlier investment in those organizers. And there's some lessons that aren't from the party, but from foundations and other groups who were slow to invest in many of the organizers in Georgia who saw the changes in the state coming a long time ago. There will be, and there already is, better investment from those groups in Texas, in places like South Carolina, and trying to shift the power base of the party away from the formal traditional organizers and more to that kind of grassroots level. I think that will continue, even if it's open to question whether the kind of campaign money will.
I was just going to say, I mean, were Ossoff and Warnock, did they motivate the voters enough on their own, or was this really a rebuke of President Trump? And Noah, I'll give you the last word on that. We've got about a minute left.
Definitely just want to say that money alone is not nearly enough. As folks mentioned, Amy McGrath's race, there was a ridiculous amount of money put in that race, and it was still a very disappointing outcome. So you do see a huge motivation by actual people on the ground who have been doing this work, regardless of whether the Democratic Party or national funders are paying attention. And we will continue to see a shift, because folks don't want to come back to this moment we're in right now ever again. And how we do that is to have the continued organizing, investment, and support that we have seen from organizations like the New Georgia Project, Fair Fight, Black Voters Matter, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Georgia Coalition for People's Agenda, and in places like Mississippi Votes, in Louisiana, the Power Coalition for Equity and Justice. I mean, you have so many folks doing this work all across the South that is just something that people just need to have that value if we don't want to come back to this moment we're in right now.
Anoa Changa is the host of the politics podcast, The Way with Anoa. Brandon Miller is a Democratic Party strategist and a partner at Chisholm Strategies, a political consulting firm in Mississippi. And Ested Herndon is a national political reporter with the New York Times. Anoa, Ested, Brandon, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, great to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And our listeners in the South have been talking to us about this, too.
I'm currently living in South Carolina. Before here, I lived in Missouri. Since moving here and with everything going on at the protests and seeing how our government is reacting to people with different skin color, my views have definitely changed, because it's obvious that in the America we live in today, it only benefits you if you look like me, if you look white. I've realized that there's systems set up in our country that never wanted Black people to win.
This is Jeff from Gainesville, Florida. Since the mid-60s, I've had a very negative image of the South. After having read about the racial inequities and harsh treatment of Blacks and seen the horrifying photos of police brutality and lynchings. Throughout life, I have gained a more nuanced view of the South, but still feel a prejudiced disdain for the inequities here. So, following retirement, I work in my community in several ways to contribute to change.
My name is Robin. I live in South Florida. All my adult life, I have been a fiscal Republican and a social Democrat. Now, everything is very different. Democrats have moved way left, a little bit too left for me socially. And Republicans, I do not even recognize the party anymore. I will never, ever vote for a Republican again for the rest of my life.
Well, my personal political leanings haven't changed, and I remain a liberal Southern woman. What most certainly has changed is my awareness and understanding of the unwillingness on both sides to engage in civil political discourse. The perceived need to cling to our political beliefs, whether based in fact or social media-based altered realities, supersedes our moral codes, our faiths, our very foundations as Americans.
I'm from Alabama and I live in Florida now. I grew up a Republican. I've changed my views. Once they elected Barack Obama, I started realizing the Republican Party was just a bunch of racists. I really want to teach my kids that. I swapped over to Democrat because there's really not a whole lot of choices.
Hi, I'm Janice, a lifelong Southerner. And although I was a high school student in 1963 Birmingham, I never actually witnessed the race riots. But I knew something was terribly wrong with how blacks were being treated. My beliefs were shared by a very tiny group of high school peers. My family was very racist, but somehow I developed what would now be called a progressive mindset. And it has only become stronger over time.
Even though I grew up in Southwest Arkansas and was raised in a conservative evangelical tradition, I've always considered myself politically neutral. I voted for Bill Clinton twice and then George W. Bush in 2000. However, in the past decade or so, I've watched as those in power on the right have lied to and manipulated the poor and less educated to vote and speak against their own self-interests on things like health care. They've done this by using emotional wedge issues that most in the GOP leadership don't really care anything about. The Republican leaders at the federal level climb on the backs of the poor to grab and keep power. Add to that the past 4 years of cowardice on the side of the GOP, failing to stand up to Trump on anything, with the exception of John McCain, and I don't see how I could ever vote Republican again.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In the United States, coronavirus vaccine distribution has not gone as smoothly as many Americans may have expected. So we're going to take a look at vaccine distribution through the eyes of local leaders. And today we turn to Missouri, where about 1 in 5 people is infected with the virus. But so far, just 30% of the state's COVID-19 vaccines have made their way into people's arms. Joining me now to discuss the vaccine rollout in his city is Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas. Mayor Lucas, thanks for joining us.
It is good to be with you.
So how would you assess the state of vaccine distribution in Kansas City, Missouri right now?
Like most parts of the country, it is nowhere close to where it needs to be. We have received our 1A distributions from the state that went directly from the state of Missouri's health department to hospitals and other outfits. So we are starting to begin to vaccinate some of those frontline workers, nurses, doctors, healthcare providers, those at nursing homes. However, there are lots of people that are saying we aren't hitting all providers, and we have had that challenge. Doctors that are not affiliated with the hospital, for example, aren't receiving the vaccine. But some something else is happening here that I think has happened in lots of other areas, New York State, et cetera, which is that hospitals have received more vaccine than they can use. And so often you have seen administrators getting vaccinated, people that don't work with patients, and in some unfortunate situations, vaccines going to waste because we haven't lined it up the way it needs to. So there is much frustration early and much more work to do.
Mayor Lucas, what do you need? Do you need help from the state, from the federal government? Who would you call on to help you right now to help coordinate these efforts more efficiently?
Well, the first change that we need is from the federal government. I am heartened by at least what the Biden administration is saying, the incoming Biden administration is saying, which is rather than holding back some of the doses of vaccines, they will give all that they have to the states. That is a really stark difference from what the Trump administration did, which for many months was arguably nothing. And then once the vaccines were here, basically handing it over to states to say, you figure it out, giving only a percentage of the supply that's necessary. So step one is actually getting the vaccine first, because that helps us plan. Step two is actually making sure that we get more vaccine to public health departments, to safety net providers, to federally qualified healthcare centers. Those are the hospitals that work with indigents, with our homeless population, with all the groups that I'm concerned, even after we've gone through lots of our vaccine distribution, we may still be missing large parts of our population. So I think it would be much better if, rather than sending off a bunch of vaccines to your local pharmacy that will disproportionately get into the arms of those in the middle class, the upper middle class and beyond, they actually were sending these vaccines to health departments to make sure we could equitably vaccinate large swaths of our population, including our Black and Brown communities that have already been highly infected disproportionately and will get access to the vaccine, I fear, in a disproportionately lower capacity.
Mayor Lucas, given the rollout of the vaccine, as we're saying, is going to take a couple more months at least, is there any other state or federal assistance that you're asking for to help your constituents get through this current wave of the pandemic?
In the spring, we certainly had lots of discussions about how the CARES Act and support to our health departments would help with testing, contact tracing. We continue to actually have the same request for federal funding to the cities to support those two endeavors. But also, as we look to vaccines, health departments will have to do a lot of work. We'll have to organize in some situations, like here in Kansas City, a convention center, larger spaces where people can wait. And with the way that the vaccine is done, you actually have to stay on site often for 15 minutes after you've received your shot. That's not the sort of thing that can be done in small clinical spaces. And so we would look to have some support from the federal government, not just on funding of that, but help in setting up those types of facilities.
Mayor Lucas, you received your first dose of the Moderna vaccine a week and a half ago, and you did it publicly to combat some of the skepticism. What's your message to Kansas City residents who are distrustful towards the vaccine?
I think it has surprised some, because there is a percentage of my population, largely white, largely folks that may be even listening to a program like this one, who say, of course everyone's going to get the vaccine. But then when you actually talk to folks, both in not just social media, which is accessible anyway, but also those even in my family who are saying, I don't trust this. I don't trust the government. They always test Black people first. I am Black. And I was thinking, we have to push back and show that, no, we do believe it's safe, that you aren't going to be a guinea pig in terms of taking the vaccine. And more to the point, that we are going to work our level best to make sure that it's available and accessible for people of all races, of all demographic groups. Throughout this crisis, there has been a bit of a messaging issue that I think we have failed to confront fully, which is that we spent so much time, I think, kind of considering left-right politics and the anti-maskers and the anti-vaxxers and all of that, and they do take up so much noise. But there are lots of people, particularly from poorer communities, that we also have needed to make sure we reach out to. We say that it's safe, it's accessible, it will be available, we'll make sure it comes available in an equitable manner, and that's why I think I've stepped up. Other Black and Brown leaders I've seen, my congressman's African-American, he's also gotten the vaccine. I think it will be so important for us to show. And I joked the other day, I don't have any control over someone like LeBron James, but someone like that, folks that have that type of global presence, I think can go a long way to making sure folks don't say we're going to wait and see. Because waiting and seeing can mean a lot more spread in a lot of our communities of color that are so disproportionately impacted now.
Mayor, some of the groups that have been talked about getting the vaccine include incarcerated individuals. The state of Missouri has put that group close to the bottom of its priority to get the vaccine. What are your thoughts on that decision?
That is absolutely shameful. There is no reason that we wouldn't take care of folks that are entrusted to the care of the people of Missouri. It's consistent with the red state politics you see in this part of the country, but it doesn't make it any less awful. Our prisoners are in close confined quarters. They do not have access to quality health care in the slightest. And we want to make sure that we're stemming any outbreaks. I'll add to that, many of them haven't been able to see their families for visits since the beginning of the crisis. These are, in many ways, inhumane conditions. We still have an Eighth Amendment. We still don't want cruel and unusual punishment. And I think allowing a virus to rage because we're not taking care of the people that we're supposed to take care of is a mistake by the leadership of Missouri.
Mayor Lucas, are you optimistic that you will be able to increase administering this vaccine in time to really prevent and put at least some sort of a hold on the spread of the virus in your community?
I am. I think that we will continue to reach out to every level of elected officials. We worked with the Trump administration to the extent that was possible. We're hopeful that the Biden administration will be better in their workings with cities. And I think we will do all we can to keep people safe and avoid the loss of lives. This is a serious time, and we need to do better.
Mayor Quentin Lucas is the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. Mayor Lucas, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Last week, Reverend Raphael Warnock made history after winning one of two Senate runoff elections in Georgia. The senior pastor of Atlanta's historic Ebenezer Baptist Church, Reverend Warnock, will become the first black senator from the state after a heated race against Republican Kelly Loeffler. Reverend Warnock won't be the first ordained member of the clergy to be in Congress, however. From Adam Clayton Powell Jr. to John Lewis, he joins a long legacy of people moving from behind the pulpit to the halls of the Capitol. The other Democratic Senate candidate, John Ossoff, was also declared the winner of his race, making him the first Jewish senator from Georgia. Here to discuss the intersection of faith and progressive politics is Yolanda Pierce, the dean of the Howard University School of Divinity. Yolanda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
How did Reverend Warnock talk about faith, and his faith in particular, on the campaign trail? Was it a big issue for him? Was it something that he really leaned into?
I think Dr. Warnock really did lean into his faith. It was clear that he was approaching his run for Senate from a justice-centered standpoint. And knowing him, knowing his work, knowing his background, I know that's deeply connected to his work as a minister, his time that he spent pastoring, but also to his academic background and his theological background. He is the product of Black liberation theology. And I think it shows up on the campaign trail, and I think it will show up in the way that he will be a senator for the next couple of years.
Yolanda, help us define that. What does it mean to say Black liberation theology? Where does that school of thinking come from, and how has it evolved?
It emerges as a school out of the 1960s, the Black Power movement, the Civil Rights movement, in which primarily African-American theologians were using this vantage point of liberation theology. And liberation theology itself made popular in Latin America at the time. The basic idea is that God is on the side of oppressed people. God is on the side of the poor and the marginalized. Instead of a theology in which God is in the centers of power with the powerful and the rich. In fact, God cares deeply about those who are on the underside of history. And so Dr. Warnock is a student of James Cone. James Cone in the academy for many of us is the father of Black theology and Black liberation theology. So it centers itself around a justice ethos in which the marginalized, the poor, the least of these have a voice before God, and that God cares for them and is on their side.
Reverend Warnock has long been a pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, which was the spiritual home of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Is that more than symbolic?
It's much more than symbolic. So Dr. Warnock has also been a pastor at Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore, Maryland. But I think the symbolism of Ebenezer Baptist Church, where King was the minister, where King's family has had a long history, and where, in fact, John Lewis, the congressman, the late congressman, was a member. It symbolizes a place in which Black religion and politics have always lived together, have always gone hand in hand. This church, like many other African-American churches, is deeply political. I think most people would argue that you cannot be a person of faith without having some foundational political beliefs. And so you see in Ebenezer a long history of men in the pulpit who have taken seriously a civic call to duty to serve at the highest levels here of government, but certainly in politics more broadly, and also connected to their faith. It is part of the progressive National Baptist movement, which of course King himself was one of the founders.
How has this runoff, and particularly the Reverend Warnock's win here, put the traditions of Black churches back into the spotlight?
I think that for some people who were unfamiliar with the African-American church, they did not realize that there has been an over 200-year history of African-Americans who are on the left, who are religious, and there is a religious left. Unfortunately, for, I would say, the past 20, 25 years, so much of the conversation has been dominated about religion in terms of the religious right, that those are the voices that we hear, those are the voices that have come to the forefront. But the African-American church has always represented the religious left. It is a religiously progressive movement, and it has been since its founding as a protest movement. So I think people are hearing that for the first time. And some, of course, are choosing to label it as radical. I think those of us on the religious left would see it as our inheritance, our faith inheritance from our ancestors who protested the racism of the white church and so therefore founded African-American churches. We've always been here.
And Yolanda, I'm wondering, you know, we have a very, in this country right now, there is a very motivated group of young Americans in particular who have turned out to the polls from all different backgrounds. We saw young Black people, young white people, young Latinos turning out to the polls this year. As the United States in many sectors becomes less religious, is someone like a Raphael Warnock going to be able to connect with perhaps the political power of the youth vote that might not be in sync with a spiritual or religious message?
I think actually what we're seeing is that while people are less religiously affiliated, they don't tend to belong to a particular church or denomination. They don't tend to ascribe to a fairly narrow group of religious beliefs. I think there actually is a deep spirituality among young people, particularly those who are involved in contemporary protest movements. And so because I believe there's a deep spirituality, I think someone like Dr. Warnock, actually will be someone that they will turn to and look to. I think people have a very deep sense of spirit, of God, that they're out there for a cause, that justice is just beyond the laws of the land. So there's a spiritualism undergirding a lot of what young folks are doing. I think Warnock is going to be a figure that they can lean on. While he belongs to the Black Baptist faith tradition, I think his message will resonate for young folks who know that it's just more than marching and rallying, that there's something bigger and beyond us.
Yolanda, John Ossoff defeated his opponent, Republican opponent David Perdue, for the state's other U.S. Senate seat. Ossoff is Jewish, and I'm wondering how much of that came up in his campaign.
I love that what we are about to see in the United States Senate are two senators who represent a historical coalition, Black voters and Jewish voters, coming out of the South. So this is a reminder to your listeners that African Americans and Jewish Americans worked together during the Civil Rights Movement. So here we are 60 years later, and we have these two men emerging out of faith traditions and historical traditions that have historically seen themselves as allies. I think it's a very big deal that we will have a Jewish senator from the South, a reminder that like Christianity, Judaism in America goes back 400 years, that there have always been Jewish Americans at the forefront of political life. I think the fact that he's from the South makes this such an interesting movement. But there have always been Southern Jews. And so I think people are really getting a wonderful lesson in American religious history. Folks have been around for a very long time doing this kind of work in their religious communities, particularly in the South.
And there is, as you mentioned, a history of Black and Jewish communities working as allies together in the fight against racism and anti-Semitism. Does that history, is it as known as it should be, particularly? And do you see this as a moment to really sort of explain that history to more folks who may not be as aware?
That history is definitely not as known as it should be. There are some people who know a little bit about Black Jewish coalitions during the civil rights movement, but they don't realize how extensive it was. It goes back to this idea that there has always been a religious left. Black Jewish coalitions have always been in favor of criminal justice reform, for example. They have always occupied some of the more left-leaning political ideologies within this country. So there's been a long-standing tradition. And both of these communities have experienced persecution because of their faith, have experienced all of these forces and powers that are of the majority looking at their faith as somehow lesser or radical or even inferior. So I think that there's far more in common with these Black Jewish coalitions galvanized around faith traditions than most people realize in this nation.
When it comes to faith-based organizing in Georgia, but of course more broadly across the South, Black churches are part of that civic infrastructure. I recall, you know, visiting a Black church in Florida under President Obama, and he was trying to get out. The president himself wasn't in the church, but they were trying to get out messages about healthcare, and they were using the Black church that I visited in order to do that. And so I'm wondering, what is it about the infrastructure of churches and maybe more broadly religious institutions that lend itself to sort of political organizing?
In the case of African American churches, because they were founded as a protest movement, because they were founded due in part to African Americans not being allowed to worship in white churches, you see a long-standing history of connecting themselves with political movements. And so politicians show up at African American churches because they know these are folks who are going to be politically engaged. The soul to the pole movements, which African American churches have been participating in for a number of years, is the idea that it is a responsibility of people of faith to show up at the polls. It is what John Lewis once said, almost sacred for them to participate in the political processes of the nation. So you have a deep connection between voting and being active politically and hosting politicians, which work hand in hand with just the regular religious beliefs. So for many of these churches, the politicians showing up on any given Sunday is an idea of, well, they're introducing themselves to the community. But more broadly, it's the community saying, you have to show up for us, and not just on election day and not just during the campaign season, but after you're elected. Here are people, look at us in our face. You are accountable to us. And I think that that has been a tremendous part of the legacy of Black churches who have been doing this for a number of years.
Well, we're also seeing a president who is a Catholic. Joe Biden is Catholic. We have not had many Catholic presidents in the United States. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on how much that might influence that level of political office, how much Biden's Catholic faith might factor into how he decides to run the country.
I think his faith shows up in a number of different ways, but not necessarily the way most people think. They're worried about the influence of Catholicism more broadly, or the influence of the Pope. What I see with President-elect Biden is someone who is quite devout and deeply pious. We see him week after week returning to his church in Delaware. The press is, you know, they're taking pictures as he's, you know, going to mass. He is actually showing up. He's walking the walk. He's not just saying, I'm a Catholic in name only, but by his devout attendance in mass, by the way that he returns back to his home church, I think we see someone who takes what he does really seriously. I think that will resonate with our nation.
And we can't, of course, neglect to mention Vice President Kamala Harris, who has described her religious upbringing as in part being a Baptist and also, you know, taking in the teachings from her mother, who was an immigrant from India, where she would go to Hindu temples. And she is now married to a Jewish man. So she's participated in some Jewish traditions and celebrations with her husband, Doug. What does that tell us about where we are when it comes to diversity of religion and religious practices at the highest office right now?
It is a wonderful moment of rich religious diversity in America. You have Judaism, you have Catholicism, you have Hinduism, you have Black Baptist, Black Christian traditions. This is what the nation looks like. Many families have not only interracial, but interreligious roots. Many families are grappling with traditions around the holidays and who celebrates what. And so this is an incredible moment for our nation that at the highest leaderships, the religious diversity that already exists in the nation is being represented. Families have had to figure this out for generations, how to live together, work together, worship their in their respective traditions and respect one another. If families can do it, then we have to believe our nation's highest leadership can do it. And that is a model for all of those who are people of faith, as well as people of no faith, as well as people who might be atheists and agnostics, because they're part of this American fabric as well. This rich religious diversity is welcome.
Yolanda Pierce is the dean of the Howard University School of Divinity. Yolanda, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all we have for you folks today. We're going to be back tomorrow to talk about the fallout from the Capitol insurrection and more. And we just want to let you know we appreciate you spending your time with us as we sort out some of these really tough issues that are facing the country. So thank you. And of course, you can call us about things you want to talk about or story ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. And we also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and send them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.